Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in 2011.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Thrilling Tales. My name is David. I'm a librarian here in the library. I work in the Reader Services Department up on 3. So if you're looking for something good to read, come and see us. Thrilling Tales happens the first and third Monday of every month. This being October, we've actually got an extra one, so it'll be 2 weeks from now and then 2 weeks again, which is right up near Halloween. And for Halloween, we tend to do a lot of scarier stories. Got some new stories coming up later in the month by contemporary authors like Roddy Doyle, Neil Gaiman. But today, we've got a couple of old stories from about a century ago. The first is called John Charrington's Wedding, and it's by E. Nesbitt. No one ever thought that May Forster would marry John Charrington, but he thought differently. And things which John Charrington intended had a queer way of coming to pass. He asked her to marry him before he went up to Oxford. She laughed and refused him. He asked her again next time he came home. Again, she laughed, tossed her dainty blonde head, and again refused. A third time, he asked her. She said it was becoming a confirmed bad habit and laughed at him more than ever. John was not the only man who wanted to marry her. She was the belle of our village coterie, and we were all in love with her, more or less. Therefore, we were as much annoyed as surprised when John Charrington walked into our little local club. We held it in a loft over the Saddlers, I remember, and invited us all to his wedding. Your wedding? You don't mean it. Who's the happy pair? When's it to be? John Charrington filled his pipe and lighted it before he replied. And then he said, I'm sorry to deprive you fellows of your only joke, but Miss Forster and I are to be married in September. You don't mean it. No, I said, rising. I see. It's true. Lend me a pistol, someone, or a first-class fare to the other end of nowhere. Charrington has bewitched the only pretty girl in our 20-mile radius. Was it mesmerism or a love potion, Jack? Neither, sir, but a gift you'll never have. Perseverance. And the best luck a man ever had in this world. The queer thing about it was that when we congratulated Miss Forster, she blushed and smiled and dimpled for all the world as though she were in love with him, and had been in love with him all the time. Upon my word, I think she had. Women are strange creatures. We were all asked to the wedding. In Brixham, everyone who was anybody knew everybody else who was anyone. My sisters were, I truly believe, more interested in the trousseau than the bride herself, and I was to be best man. The coming marriage was much canvassed at afternoon tea tables and at our little club over the Saddlers, and the question was always asked, does she care for him? I used to ask that question myself in the early days of their engagement, but after a certain evening in August, I never asked it again. I was coming home from the club through the churchyard. Our church is on a time-grown hill, and the turf about it is so thick and soft that one's footsteps are noiseless. I made no sound as I vaulted the low, lichened wall and threaded my way between the tombstones. It was at the same instant that I heard John Charrington's voice and saw her. May was sitting on a low, flat gravestone, her face turned towards the full splendor of the western sun. Its expression ended at once and forever any question of love for him. It was transfigured to a beauty I should not have believed possible, even to that beautiful little face. John lay at her feet, and it was his voice that broke the stillness of the golden August evening. My dear, I believe I should come back from the dead if you wanted me. I coughed at once to indicate my presence and passed on into the shadow, fully enlightened. The wedding was to be early in September. 2 days before, I had to run up to town on business. The train was late, of course, and as I stood grumbling with my watch in my hand, whom should I see but John Charrington and May Forster? They were walking up and down the unfrequented end of the platform, arm in arm, looking into each other's eyes. Of course, I knew better than to hesitate a moment before burying myself in the booking office, and it was not till the train drew up at the platform that I obtrusively passed the pair with my Gladstone and took the corner in a first-class smoking carriage. I did this with as good an air of not seeing them as I could assume. I pride myself on my discretion, but if John were traveling alone, I wanted his company. I had it. "Hello, old man," came his cheery voice as he swung his bag into my carriage. "Here's luck. I was expecting a dull journey." "Where are you off to?" I asked. "To old Banbridge's," he answered, shutting the door and leaning out for a last word with his sweetheart. "I wish you wouldn't go, John," she was saying in a low, earnest voice. "I feel certain something will happen." "Do you think that I should let anything happen to keep me and the day after tomorrow our wedding day?" "Don't go," she answered with a pleading intensity which would have sent my Gladstone onto the platform and me after it. But she wasn't speaking to me. John Charrington was made differently. He rarely changed his opinions, never his resolutions. He only stroked the little ungloved hands that lay on the carriage door. "I must, May. The old boy's been awfully good to me, and now he's dying. I must go and see him. But I shall come home in time." "You're sure to come," she spoke as the train moved. "Nothing shall keep me," he answered, and we steamed out. After he had seen the last of the little figure on the platform, he leaned back in his corner and kept silence for a minute. When he spoke, it was to explain to me that his godfather, whose heir he was lying at Peasmarsh Place, some 50 miles away, and had sent for him, and John felt bound to go. "I shall surely be back tomorrow," he said, "or if not the day after, in heaps of time." "And suppose Mr. Banbridge does die?" "Alive or dead, I mean to be married on Thursday," John answered, lighting a cigar and unfolding the Times. At Peasmarsh Station, we said goodbye, and he got out, and I saw him ride off. I went to London, where I stayed the night. When I got home the next afternoon, a very wet one, by the way, my sister greeted me with, "Where's Mr. Charrington?" "Well, goodness knows," I answered, testily. "I thought you might have heard from him," she went on, "as you're giving him away tomorrow." "Well, isn't he back?" I asked, for I had confidently expected to find him at home. "No, Geoffrey," my sister Fanny always has a way of jumping to conclusions, especially such conclusions as were least favorable to her fellow creatures. "He has not returned, and what is more, you may depend on it, he won't. You mark my words, there'll be no wedding tomorrow." My sister Fanny has a power of annoying me which no other human being possesses. "You mark my words," I retorted with asperity. "You better give up making such a thundering idiot of yourself. There'll be more wedding tomorrow than you'll ever take the first part in." A prophecy which, by the way, came true. But though I could snarl confidently at my sister, I did not feel so comfortable when, late that night, I, standing on the doorstep of John's house, heard that he had not returned. I went home gloomily through the rain. Next morning brought a brilliant blue sky, gold sun, and all such softness of air and beauty of cloud as go to make up a perfect day. I woke with a vague feeling of having gone to bed anxious, but with my shaving water came a note from John, which relieved my mind and set me up to the Forsters with a light heart. May was in the garden, so I did not go up to the house, but turned aside on the turfed path. "He's written to you, too," she said, without preliminary greeting, when I reached her side. "Yes, I'm to meet him at the station at 3 and come straight to the church." Her face looked pale, but there was a brightness in her eyes and a tender quiver about the mouth that spoke of renewed hopefulness and happiness. "Mr. Banbridge begged him so to stay another night that he had not the heart to refuse," she went on. "He is so kind. But I wish he hadn't stayed." I was at the station at 2:30. I felt rather annoyed with John. It seemed a sort of slight to the beautiful girl who loved him that he should come, as it were, out of breath and with a dust of travel upon him to take her hand, which some of us would have given the best years of our lives to take. But when the 3 o'clock train glided in and glided out again, having brought no passengers to our little station, I was more than annoyed. There was no other train for 35 minutes. I calculated that with much hurry, we might just get to the church in time for the ceremony, but oh, what a fool to miss that first train! What other man could have done it? That 35 minutes seemed a year as I wandered around the station reading the advertisements and the timetables and the company's bylaws and getting more and more angry with John Charrington. This confidence in his own power of getting everything he wanted the minute he wanted it was leading him too far. I hate waiting. Everybody does. But I believe I hate it more than anyone else. The 3:35 was late, of course. "Drive to the church," I said, as someone shut the door. "Mr. Charrington has not come by this train." I ground my pipe between my teeth and stamped with impatience as I flung myself into the carriage that I had brought for John. Anxiety now replaced anger. What had become of the man? Could he have been taken suddenly ill? I'd never known him to have a day's illness in his life. Even so, he might have telegraphed. Some awful accident must have happened to him. The thought that he had played her false never, no, not for a moment, entered my head. It was 5 minutes to four as we drew up at the churchyard gate. A double row of eager onlookers lined the path from lych gate to porch. I sprang from the carriage and passed up between them. Our gardener had a good front place near the door. I stopped. "Are they waiting still, Biles?" I asked, simply to gain time, for of course I knew that they were by the waiting crowd's attentive attitude. "Waiting, sir? Oh, no, no, sir. Why, it must be over by now." "Over? Then Mr. Charrington's come?" "To the minute, sir. He must have missed you somehow. And if I say, sir," lowering his voice, "I never seen Mr. John the least bit so afore. But my opinion is he's been drinking pretty free. His clothes was all dusty and his face like a sheet. I tell you, I don't like the looks of him at all, and the folks inside are saying all sorts of things. You see, something's gone very wrong with Mr. John, and he's tried liquor. He looked like a ghost, and in he went with his eyes straight before him and never a look or word to none of us, him that was always such a gentleman." I'd never heard Biles make so long a speech. The crowd in the churchyard were talking in whispers and getting ready rice and slippers to throw at the bride and bridegroom. The ringers were ready with their hands on the ropes to ring out the merry peal as the bride and bridegroom should come out. A murmur from the church announced them. Out they came. Biles was right. John Charrington did not look himself. There was dust on his coat. His hair was disarranged. He seemed to have been in some row, for there was a black mark above his eyebrow. He was deathly pale, but his pallor was not greater than that of the bride, who might have been carved in ivory, dress, veil, orange blossoms, face and all. As they passed out, the ringers stooped. There were six of them. And then, on the ears, expecting the gay wedding peal, came the slow funereal tolling of the passing bell. A thrill of horror at so foolish a jest from the ringers passed through us all, but the ringers themselves dropped the ropes and fled like rabbits out into the sunlight. The bride shuddered, and gray shadows came about her mouth, but the bridegroom led her on down the path where the people stood with the handfuls of rice, but the handfuls were never thrown, and the wedding bells never rang. In vain the ringers were urged to remedy their mistake. They protested that many whispered expletives, that they would see themselves further first. In a hush, like the hush in the chamber of death, the bridal pair passed into their carriage and its door slammed behind them. Then the tongues were loosed, a babel of anger, wonder, conjecture from the guests and the spectators. "If I'd seen his condition, sir," said old Forster to me as we drove off, "I would have stretched him on the floor of the church, sir, by heaven I would, before I'd have let him marry my daughter." And he put his head out the window. "Drive like hell," he cried to the coachman. "Don't spare the horses." He was obeyed. We passed the bride's carriage. I forbore to look at it, and old Forster turned his head away and swore. We reached home before it. We stood in the doorway in the blazing afternoon sun. In about half a minute, we heard wheels crunching the gravel. When the carriage stopped in front of the steps, old Forster and I ran down. Great heavens, the carriage is empty. And yet, I had the door open in a minute, and this is what I saw. No sign of John Charrington, and of May, his wife, only a huddled heap of white satin lying half on the floor of the carriage and half on the seat. "I drove straight here, sir," said the coachman as the bride's father lifted her out. "And I'll swear no one got out of this carriage." We carried her into the house in her bridal dress and drew back her veil. I saw her face. Shall I ever forget it? White. White and drawn with agony and horror, bearing such a look of terror as I have never seen since except in dreams. And her hair, her radiant blonde hair, I tell you, it was white like snow. As we stood, her father and I, half mad with the horror and mystery of it, a boy came up the avenue, a telegraph boy. They brought the orange envelope to me. I tore it open. Mr. Charrington was thrown from the dog cart on his way to the station at 1:30. Killed on the spot. And he was married to May Forster in our parish church at 3:30, in the presence of half the parish. I shall be married, dead or alive. What had passed in that carriage on the homeward drive, no one knows. No one will ever know. Before a week was over, they laid her beside her husband in our little churchyard on the thyme-covered hill. The churchyard where they'd kept their love trysts. And thus was accomplished John Charrington's wedding. Little old-timey ghost story. Now another old-timey story. This one is by a writer named William Hope Hodgson, who wrote weird tales and also nautical stories, and sometimes the two together. And it's called The Voice in the Night. It was a dark, starless night. We were becalmed in the northern Pacific. Our exact position, I do not know, for the sun had been hidden during the course of a weary, breathless week by a thin haze which had seemed to float above us, above the height of our mastheads, at whiles descending and shrouding the surrounding sea. With there being no wind, we had steadied the tiller, and I was the only man on deck. The crew, consisting of two men and a boy, were sleeping forward in their den, while Will, my friend and the master of our little craft, was aft in his bunk. Suddenly, from out of the surrounding darkness, there came a hail. "Schooner! Ahoy!" The cry was so unexpected that I gave no immediate answer because of my surprise. It came again, a voice curiously throaty and inhuman, calling from somewhere upon the dark sea away on our port broadside. "Schooner! Ahoy!" "Hello," I sung out, having gathered my wits somewhat. "Who are you? What do you want?"
"You need not be afraid," answered the queer voice, having probably noticed some trace of confusion in my tone. "I am only an old man."
The pause sounded oddly, but it was only afterwards that it came back to me with any significance. "Why don't you come alongside, then?" I queried somewhat snappishly, for I liked not his hinting at my having been a trifle shaken.
I can't. It wouldn't be safe.
The voice broke off, and there was silence. "What do you mean?" I asked, growing more and more astonished. "Why not safe? Where are you?" I listened for a moment, but there came no answer, and then, a sudden, indefinite suspicion of I know not what coming to me, I stepped swiftly to the binnacle and took out the lighted lamp. At the same time, I knocked on the deck with my heel to waken Will. Then I was back at the side, throwing the yellow funnel of light out into the silent immensity beyond our rail. And as I did so, I heard a slight muffled cry, and then the sound of a splash as though someone had dipped oars abruptly. Yet I cannot say that I saw anything with certainty, save it seemed to me that with the first flash of the light there had been something upon the waters where now there was nothing. "Hello there!" I called. "What foolery is this?" But there came only the indistinct sounds of a boat being pulled away into the night. Then I heard Will's voice from the direction of the aft scuttle. "What's up, George?" "Come here, Will," I said. "What is it?" he asked, coming across the deck. I told him the queer thing that had happened. He put several questions, and then after a moment's silence, he raised his hands to his lips and hailed, "Boat, ahoy!" This time there was a reply.
"Put away the light."
"I'm damned if I will," I muttered, but Will told me to do as the voice bade, and I shoved it down under the bulwarks. "Come nearer," he said. And the oar strokes continued, and then when apparently some half dozen fathoms distant, they again ceased. "Come alongside," exclaimed Will. "There's nothing to be frightened above aboard here."
"Promise that you will not show the light."
"What's that to do with you?" I burst out, "that you're so infernally afraid of the light." Will put his hand on my shoulder. "Shut up a minute, old man," he said in a low voice. "Let me tackle him." He leant more over the rail. "See here, mister," he said. "This is a pretty queer business, you coming upon us like this, right out in the middle of the blessed Pacific. I mean, how are we to know what sort of hanky-panky you're up to? You say there's only one of you. Well, how are we to know unless we get a squint at you, eh? And what's your objection to the light, anyway?" The voice came, sounding extremely hopeless and pathetic.
"I'm sorry. I would not have troubled you, only I am hungry, and so is she."
The voice died away, and the sound of oars dipping irregularly was borne to us. "Stop!" sung out Will. I don't want to drive you away. Come back. We'll keep the light hidden if you don't like it." He turned to me. "It's a damned queer rig, this, but I think there's nothing to be afraid of." There was a question in his tone, and I replied, "No, I think the poor devil's been wrecked around here and gone crazy." Sound of the oars drew nearer. "Shove that lamp back in the binnacle," said Will, and he leaned over the rail and listened. The dipping of the oars ceased some dozen yards distant. "Won't you come alongside now?" asked Will in an even voice. "The lamp is put back in the binnacle."
"I cannot," replied the voice. "I dare not come nearer. I dare not even pay you for the provisions."
"Oh, that's all right," said Will, and hesitated. "You're welcome to as much grub as you can take." Again he hesitated.
"You are very good," exclaimed the voice. "May God, who understands everything, reward you."
It broke off huskily. "And the lady," said Will abruptly, "is she..."
"I have left her behind on the island," came the voice.
"What island?" I cut in.
"I know not its name," returned the voice. "I would to God..."
It began and checked itself as suddenly. "Could we not send a boat for her?" asked Will at this point.
"No," said the voice with extraordinary emphasis. "My God, no!"
There was a moment's pause, and then it added in a tone which seemed a merited reproach.
"It was because of our want I ventured, because her agony tortured me."
I'm a forgetful brute," exclaimed Will. "Just wait a minute, whoever you are. I'll bring you up something at once." And in a couple of minutes, he was back again, and his arms were full of various edibles. He paused at the rail. "Can't you come alongside for them?" he asked.
"No, I dare not,"
replied the voice. And it seemed to me that in its tones I detected a note of stifled craving, as though the owner hushed a mortal desire. It came to me then in a flash that the poor old creature out there in the darkness was suffering from actual need of that which Will held in his arms, and yet, because of some unintelligible dread, refrained from dashing to the side of our little schooner and receiving it. And with the lightning-like conviction, there came the knowledge that the invisible was not mad, but sanely facing some intolerable horror. "Damn it, Will," I said, full of many feelings over which predominated a vast sympathy. "Get a box. We must float the stuff off to him in it." And this we did, propelling it away from the vessel, out into the darkness, by means of a boat hook. In a minute, a slight cry from the invisible came to us, and we knew that he had secured the box. A little later, he called out a farewell to us, and so heartful a blessing that I'm sure we were the better for it. Then, without more ado, we heard the ply of oars across the darkness. "Pretty soon off," remarked Will. "Wait," I replied. "I think somehow he'll come back. He must have been badly needing that food." "And the lady," said Will. "It's the queerest thing I've ever tumbled across since I've been fishing." "Yes," I said, and fell to pondering. And so the time slipped away, an hour and another, and still Will stayed with me, for the queer adventure had knocked all desire for sleep out of him. The third hour was three parts through, when we heard again the sound of oars across the silent ocean. "Listen," said Will. "He's coming, just as I thought," I muttered. The dipping of the oars grew nearer, and I noted that the strokes were firmer and longer. The food had been needed. They came to a stop a little distance off the broadside, and the voice came again to us through the darkness. "Schooner, ahoy!" "That you?" asked Will. "Yes," replied the voice. "I left you suddenly, but there was great need." "The lady?" questioned Will. "The lady is grateful now on earth. She will be more grateful soon in heaven." We began to make some reply, but became confused and broke off short. The voice continued, "She and I have talked as we shared the result of God's tenderness and yours." It stopped, and there was a full minute's silence, and then it came again. "We have spoken together upon that which has befallen us. We had thought to go out without telling any of the terror which has come into our lives. She is with me in believing that tonight's happenings are under a special ruling, and that it is God's wish that we should tell to you all that we have suffered since... "Yes," said Will softly. "Since the sinking of the Albatross." "Ah!" I exclaimed involuntarily. "She left Newcastle for Frisco some 6 months ago, and hasn't been heard of since." "Yes," answered the voice, "but some few degrees to the north of the line, she was caught in a terrible storm and dismasted. When the day came, it was found that she was leaking badly, and presently, it falling to a calm, the sailors took to the boats, leaving a young lady, my fiancée, and myself upon the wreck. We were below, gathering together a few of our belongings. When they left, they were entirely callous through fear, and when we came out upon the deck, we saw them only as small shapes far off upon the horizon. Yet we did not despair, but set to work and constructed a small raft. Upon this we put such few matters as it would hold, including a quantity of water and some ship's biscuit. Then, the vessel being very deep in the water, we got ourselves on the raft and pushed off. For 4 days we drifted through a strange haze, until on the evening of the fourth day there grew upon our ears the murmur of breakers at a distance. Gradually it became plainer, and somewhat after midnight it appeared to sound upon either hand at no very great space. The raft was raised upon a swell several times, and then we were in smooth water, and the noise of the breakers was behind. When the morning came, we found that we were in a sort of a great lagoon, but of this we noticed little at the time, for close before us, through the enshrouding mist, loomed the hull of a large sailing vessel. With one accord, we fell upon our knees and thanked God, for we thought that here was an end to our perils. We had much to learn. The raft drew near to the ship, and we shouted on them to take us aboard, but none answered. Presently the raft touched against the side of the vessel, and seeing a rope hanging downwards, I seized it and began to climb. Yet I had much ado to make my way up because of a kind of a gray lichenous fungus which had seized upon the rope and which blotched the side of the ship lividly. I reached the rail and clambered over it onto the deck. And here I saw that the decks were covered in great patches with gray masses, some of them rising into nodules several feet in height.
But at the time, I thought less of this matter than of the possibility of there being people aboard the ship. I shouted, but none answered. Then I went to the door of the poop deck. I opened it and peered in. There was a great smell of staleness, so that I knew in a moment that nothing living was within. And with the knowledge, I shut the door quickly, for I felt suddenly lonely. I went back to the side where I had scrambled up. My sweetheart was still sitting quietly upon the raft, and seeing me look down, she called up to know whether there were any aboard the ship. I replied that the vessel had the appearance of having been long deserted, but that if she would wait a little, I would see whether there was anything in the shape of a ladder by which she could ascend to the deck, and then we would make search through the vessel together. A little later, I found a rope side ladder. This I carried across, and a minute afterwards, she was beside me. Together we explored the cabins and apartments in the after part of the ship, but nowhere was there any sign of life. Here and there, within the cabins themselves, we came across odd patches of that queer fungus. But this, as my sweetheart said, could be cleansed away. In the end, having assured ourselves that the after portion of the vessel was empty, we picked our ways to the bows between the ugly gray nodules of that strange growth, and here we made a further search which told us that there was indeed none aboard but ourselves. This being now beyond any doubt, we returned to the stern of the ship and proceeded to make ourselves as comfortable as possible. Together we cleared out and cleaned two of the cabins, and after that I made examination where there was anything eatable in the ship. This I soon found was so, and thanked God in my heart for his goodness. In addition to this, I discovered the whereabouts of the fresh water pump, and having fixed it, I found the water drinkable, though somewhat unpleasant to the taste. For several days we stayed aboard the ship. Without attempting to get to the shore, we were busily engaged in making the place habitable. Yet even thus early we became aware that our lot was even less to be desired than might have been imagined. For though, as a first step, we scraped away at the odd patches of growth that studded the floors and walls of the cabins and saloon, yet they returned almost to their original size within the space of 24 hours, which not only discouraged us, but gave us a feeling of vague unease. Still, we would not admit to ourselves that we were beaten, so we set to work afresh and not only scraped away the fungus, but soaked the places where it had been with carbolic, a canful of which I'd found in the pantry. Yet by the end of the week, the growth had returned in full strength, and in addition, it had spread to other places, as though our touching it had allowed germs from it to travel elsewhere. On the seventh morning, my sweetheart woke to find a small patch of it growing on her pillow, close to her face. At that she came to me so soon as she could get her garments upon her. I was in the galley at the time, lighting the fire for breakfast. "Come here, John," she said, and led me aft. And when I saw the thing upon her pillow, I shuddered. And then and there we agreed to go right out of the ship and see whether we could not fare to make ourselves more comfortable ashore. Hurriedly, we gathered together our few belongings, and even among these I found that the fungus had been at work, for one of her shawls had a little lump of it growing near one edge. I threw the whole thing over the side without saying anything to her. The raft was still alongside, but it was too clumsy to guide, and I lowered down a small boat that hung across the stern, and in this we made our way to the shore. Yet as we drew near to it, I became gradually aware that here the vile fungus, which had driven us from the ship, was growing riot. In places it rose into horrible, fantastic mounds, which seemed almost to quiver, as with a quiet life when the wind blew across them. Odd places it appeared as grotesque, stunted trees, seemed extraordinarily kinked and gnarled, the whole quaking vilely at times. At first it seemed to us that there was no single portion of the surrounding shore which was not hidden beneath the masses of the hideous lichen. Yet in this I found we were mistaken, for somewhat later, coasting along the shore at a little distance, we descried a smooth white patch of what appeared to be a fine sand, and there we landed. It was not sand. What it was, I do not know. All that I have observed is that upon it the fungus will not grow, while everywhere else save where the sand-like earth wanders oddly, pathwise, amid the gray desolation of the lichen. There is nothing but that loathsome grayness. It's difficult to make you understand how cheered we were to find one place that was absolutely free from the growth. And here we deposited our belongings, and then we went back to the ship for such things as it seemed to us we should need. Among other matters, I managed to bring ashore with me one of the ship's sails, with which I constructed two small tents, which, though exceedingly rough-shaped, served the purpose for which they were intended. And in these we lived and stored our various necessities, and thus for a matter of some 4 weeks all went smoothly and without particular unhappiness. Indeed, I may say with much of happiness, for we were together. It was on the thumb of her right hand that the growth first showed. It was only a small circular spot, much like a little gray mole. Oh, my God, how the fear leapt to my heart when she showed me the place. We cleansed it between us, washing it with carbolic and water. In the morning of the following day, she showed her hand to me again. The gray, warty thing had returned. For a little while, we looked at one another in silence. And then, still wordless, we started again to remove it. In the midst of the operation, she spoke suddenly. "What's that upon the side of your face, dear?" Her voice was sharp with anxiety. I put my hand up to feel. "There, under the hair by your ear, a little to the front, a bit." And my finger rested upon the place, and then I knew. "Let us get your thumb done first," I said, and she submitted, only because she was afraid to touch me until it was cleansed. I finished washing and disinfecting her thumb, and then she turned to my face. After it was finished, we sat together and talked a while of many things, for there had come into our lives sudden, very terrible thoughts, and we were all at once afraid of something worse than death. We spoke of loading the boat with provisions and water and making our way out onto the sea, yet we were helpless for many causes, and the growth had attacked us already. We decided to stay. God would do with us what was his will. We would wait. A month, 2 months, 3 months passed, and the places grew somewhat, and there had come others, yet we fought so strenuously with the fear that its headway was but slow, comparatively speaking. We had now given up all thought or hope of leaving the island. We had realized that it would be unallowable to go among healthy humans with the thing from which we were suffering. With this determination and knowledge in our minds, we knew that we should have to husband our food and water, for we did not know at that time, but that we should possibly live for many years. But we had no idea then how little food there was left of which to take care. It was a week later that I made the discovery that all the other bread tanks, which I had supposed full, were empty, and that beyond odd tins of vegetables and meat and some other matters, we had nothing on which to depend but the bread in the tank which I had already opened. After learning this, I bestirred myself to do what I could, and I set to work at fishing in the open sea. Here, at times, I caught odd fish, but so unfrequently that they proved but little help in keeping us from the hunger which threatened. It seemed to me that our deaths would likely come by hunger, and not by the growth of the thing which had seized upon our bodies. We were in this state of mind when the fourth month wore out. Then I made a very horrible discovery. One morning, a little before midday, I came off from the ship with a portion of the biscuits which were left. In the mouth of her tent, I saw my sweetheart sitting, eating something. "What is it, my dear?" I called as I leapt ashore, yet on hearing my voice, she seemed confused, and turning slyly threw something towards the edge of the little clearing. It fell short, and a vague suspicion having arisen within me, I walked across and picked it up. It was a piece of the gray fungus. As I went to her with it in my hand, she turned deadly pale and then a rose red. I felt strangely dazed and frightened. Gradually, as she calmed, I got from her the news that she had tried it on the preceding day and liked it. I got her to promise on her knees not to touch it again, however great our hunger. After she had promised, she told me that the desire for it had come suddenly, and that until the moment of desire, she'd experienced nothing towards it but the most extreme repulsion. Later in the day, feeling strangely restless and much shaken with the thing which I had discovered, I made my way along one of the twisted paths formed by the white, sand-like substance which led among the fungoid growth. I had once before ventured along there, but to no great distance. This time, being involved in perplexing thought, I went much further than hitherto. And suddenly I was called to myself by a queer, hoarse sound on my left. Turning quickly, I saw that there was movement among an extraordinarily shaped mass of fungus close to my elbow. It was swaying uneasily, as though it possessed life of its own. Abruptly as I stared, the thought came to me that the thing had a grotesque resemblance to the figure of a distorted human creature. Even as the fancy flashed into my brain, there was a slight sickening noise of tearing, and I saw that one of the branch-like arms was detaching itself from the surrounding gray masses and coming towards me. The head of the thing, a shapeless gray ball, inclined in my direction. I stood stupidly, and the vile arm brushed across my face. I gave out a frightened cry, and I ran back a few paces. There was a sweetish taste upon my lips where the thing had touched me. I licked them and was immediately filled with an inhuman desire. I turned and seized a mass of the fungus, and then more and more. I was insatiable. In the midst of devouring, the remembrance of the morning's discovery swept into my mazed brain. I dashed the fragment I held to the ground, and then, utterly wretched and feeling a dreadful guiltiness, I made my way back to the little encampment. I think she knew, by some marvelous intuition which love must have given so soon as she set eyes on me. Her quiet sympathy made it easier for me, and I told her of my sudden weakness, yet omitted to mention the extraordinary thing which had gone before. I desired to spare her all unnecessary terror, but for myself I had added an intolerable knowledge to breed an incessant terror in my brain, for I doubted not but that I had seen the end of one of those men who had come to the island in the ship in the lagoon, and in that monstrous ending I had seen our own. Thereafter we kept from the abominable food, though the desire for it had entered into our blood. Yet our drear punishment was upon us, for day by day, with monstrous rapidity, the fungoid growth took hold of our poor bodies. Nothing we could do would check it materially, and so we who had been human became... Well, it matters less each day. Only we had been man and maid. And day by day the fight is more dreadful to withstand the hunger, lust for the terrible lichen. A week ago we ate the last of the biscuit, and since that time I've caught 3 fish. I was out here fishing tonight when your schooner drifted upon me out of the mist. I hailed you, you know the rest. And may God, out of his great heart, bless you for your goodness to a couple of poor outcast souls. There was a dip of the oar, and another, and then the voice came again, and for the last time, sounding through the slight surrounding mist, ghostly and mournful. God bless you. Goodbye. Goodbye, we shouted together. I glanced about me. I became aware that the dawn was upon us. The sun flung a stray beam across the hidden sea, pierced the mist dully, and lit up the receding boat with a gloomy fire. Indistinctly, I saw something nodding between the oars. I thought of a sponge, a great gray nodding sponge. The oars continued to ply. They were gray, as was the boat, and my eyes searched a moment vainly for the conjunction of hand and oar. My gaze flashed back to the head. It nodded forward as the oars went backward for the stroke. Then the oars were dipped. The boat shot out of the patch of light, and the thing went nodding into the mist. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.